All right, there we go. All right. Remember the teaching about men's brains, women's brains, and women's brains are ball of wire? I'm starting to feel that way now. I'm just, boy. All right, we're in chapter 37, verse 1. It says, Jacob settled in the land of his father's sojournings, in the land of Canaan. These are the chronicles of Jacob. Joseph, at the age of 17 years, was a shepherd with his brothers by the flock. But he was a youth with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph would bring evil reports to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, since he was a child of his old age. And he made him a fine woolen tunic. His brothers saw that it was he whom their father loved most of all, his brothers. So they hated him, and they could not speak to him peaceably. Joseph dreamt a dream, which he told to his brothers, and they hated him even more. He said to them, "Hear, if you please, this dream which I dreamt. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the middle of the field, when behold, my sheaf arose, and also remained standing. Then behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Unfortunately, this story's been turned into children's movies and cartoons, and it's become a Bible story, and we can lose the impact of the of how major Joseph is in the story of the Scriptures. Now, one of the first things, and if you read this in Hebrew, it's almost shocking, is when it says there in verse 2, these are the toldot, is the Hebrew word. These are the toldot of Jacob. Now that word, toldot, is found 11 times in the Bible. 10 times in Genesis, and one time in the book of Numbers. 10 times, though, in Genesis. Because toldot means generations, or genealogy. And the other times we find it, back in chapter 5, it says these are the toldot of Adam, and it gives all the genealogy of Adam and his children. Chapter 6, it gives the toldot of Noah, and then of his three sons. And then in chapter 10, it says the toldot of the sons of Noah. And then it gives all of their the sons' sons and how all the families of the earth branched out. Chapter 11, the toldot of Shem and all his offspring. In chapter 11, it gives the toldot of Terah, who was Abraham's father, and shows how Abraham and his nephew Lot and the wives and how everybody worked and gives the whole family tree. In chapter 25, it gives the toldot of Ishmael. And chapter 25, a little later, verse 19, gives the toldot of Isaac. And then twice, in chapter 36, it gives the toldot of Esau. So you understand the word toldot means generations, genealogy, family tree. And then we come to the last place that's found in Genesis, right here in chapter 37. It says, these are the toldot. This is the family tree. This is the genealogy of Jacob's offspring. And then it mentions Joseph. Joseph. Now to the rabbis, this is shocking. And they begin to realize that God is telling us something very important here. That all of Jacob's offspring, all the fruit of his life, all the fruit of his being is summed up in this one son, Joseph. And this is as it should be, because Joseph is a giant in the Scriptures. In fact, as we're going to be seeing over coming weeks, there is no figure in the entire Hebrew Scriptures whose life more perfectly pictures the life of Messiah Yeshua than this one, Joseph. You know, in Hebrew, when they give a name, in Hebrew they didn't have first names and last names in the ancient days. So they would say, this is so-and-so, son of so-and-so. Or this is so-and-so, daughter of so-and-so. So you would have your name, and then son of, and then your father's name. And this it got transferred to be used for people who are just like other people. So you might have Joe Ben Samuel, Joseph, son of Samuel. So his father's name is Samuel. Or you might have Larry Ben Carl, Larry, son of Carl. But if Larry becomes a disciple of someone, some rabbi, and turns out his father, Carl, is really kind of a heel. A lot of times they would say Larry, son of, and put the rabbi's name in there because he became just like him. This is why converts who leave the Gentile world, the idol-worshipping world, they convert to Judaism, they automatically become so-and-so ben Avraham, son of Abraham. Why? Because they're doing what Abraham did. Abraham was an idol worshiper in Babylon. He heard God's voice. He left everything familiar to follow God. So you say any Gentile who does that is walking in the steps of Abraham, and he's called a ben Avraham. And Paul plays on this in Romans when he says all of us who are following Messiah and following God, we're all sons of Abraham. And that's what he's talking about. Paul refers to Timothy as his son in the faith because Timothy was Paul's disciple and he learned everything Paul could teach him about the Word, about Messiah, about the Scriptures and how they all point to Messiah. He taught him how to live, how to teach, how to plant congregations. So isn't it interesting that Yeshua would have been called Yeshua ben Yosef? Because Mary's husband's name was Joseph. But there's a spiritual application to this because Yeshua is just like Joseph. Or maybe I should say, just Joseph is the perfect, most perfect picture we'd ever find in the Scriptures of Yeshua. It's an amazing thing to think about. Now this brings up something that I really want us to listen to. I want us to get into some of the Jewish traditional teachings about Joseph. You might be very shocked to hear some of the things they have to say about this man. The Midrash Rabbah. Now, the Midrash Rabbah means the great Midrash, the great study. Darash means to search. Midrash is what you find when you search. And the middle two words of the Torah are Darosh Darash, spelled the same way. It means diligently search. Searching you shall search. The very middle of the Torah, the two words in the middle, Darosh Darash, it's kind of telling us something. The heart of the Torah, we are to be searching, always consuming it, chewing upon it, meditating on it, never letting the Torah depart from our mouths, always talking about it. And the Midrash Rabbah means the great search, the great Bible study. And the teachings in this massive commentary were very, very, very well known in the days of Yeshua. And there's so many things in our New Testaments that are explained only by looking at the Midrash Rabbah. But that's another story. So let me give you a quote. The Midrash Rabbah says, Joseph was worthy that 12 tribes should emerge from him, just as they emerge from our father Jacob. In other words, they're taking Joseph and they're saying he's just as worthy as Israel himself to have 12 tribes. In fact, they say that Joseph is the true firstborn of Jacob. Now, if you look at the family tree of Jacob, you'll see that Jacob had 12 sons and Joseph was number 11. He's way at the bottom. But think about something. When Jacob went to Padan Aram, and he worked for Laban, and he worked 7 years to marry Rachel, remember that? Rachel's the one he fell in love with. Rachel's the one he worked for. Rachel's the one he desired for his wife. He worked 7 years. They have the wedding with a veil. Must have been a very thick veil. And they go into the honeymoon suite where it's very dark. And the next morning he realizes it's not Rachel, it's Leah. And so Leah, over time, she gives birth to 6 sons. Rachel gives her handmaid to Jacob to compete. And she gives birth to 2 sons. So Leah then gives her handmaid to Jacob. She has 2 sons. And then finally, Rachel has a son, Joseph. Now, here's the thing to keep in mind. If Laban had not deceived Jacob, would Jacob have married... If Laban had not deceived Jacob, would Jacob have ever married Leah? No. He'd have married Rachel. Rachel had a hard time conceiving, but eventually she had a son, Joseph. So Jacob always looked at Joseph as being his true firstborn, because he was the first son of the beloved one whom he desired and worked to marry. You follow? All right. The one commentary, one of the rabbis writes, monarchy, the kingship, belongs to Judah. We know that from scriptures. The kings of Israel all came through the tribe of Judah. David was in the tribe of Judah. Yeshua was from the tribe of Judah. He said all the priestly service belongs to Levi. Of course, all the priests, the Kohanim, descended from Levi. All the great scholars came from Issachar, the tribe of Issachar. You don't hear too much about Issachar, but traditionally in Judaism, the great scholars of Israel have always been descendants of Issachar. Then listen what the rabbi says. In all of these areas, monarchy, priesthood, and scholarship, Joseph was the forerunner of his eventual successors. Hear what this rabbinic commentator is saying? He's saying Joseph is the perfect picture of a king because he ruled as a king in Egypt. He wasn't called a king. He was always seen as under Pharaoh. That's another story. But he ruled as the perfect king. He is seen as being a priest because God spoke directly to him and he prayed to God and he had this communion with God that was unlike so many others. And he's considered to be the greatest of scholars. Joseph is seen in rabbinic tradition as being the perfection of a king, a priest, and a scholar of Torah. The rabbis also point out that Abraham had a lapse in faith, Isaac had a lapse in faith, Jacob had a lapse in faith, but never, ever, ever do we see the scriptures telling us that Joseph ever had a lapse in his faith. His faith was greater than his father, grandfather, great-grandfather. Now, we need to take this another step. And I know many of you are familiar with what I'm about to share with you, but it's good review anyway. You know, in Judaism, they look at the prophecies concerning the Messiah. Of course, in Judaism, they don't believe the Messiah has come yet, unless they are Messianic Jews. But in Judaism, in mainstream Judaism, they're still awaiting the coming of the Messiah. And they look at the prophecies about the Messiah, and they see two kinds of prophecies, and they try to reconcile these. On the one hand, if they see all these prophecies about a Messiah who's coming with the clouds, he descends from heaven. He comes in as a conquering king. He brings peace on earth. He establishes Israel as the greatest of nations, Jerusalem as the greatest of cities, and he reigns on the throne of David. And they see these prophecies, but then they see the prophets talking about a Messiah who comes riding on the back of a donkey. He's despised. He's rejected. He suffers for the sins of everyone else. He's not recognized. He's not attractive looking. And he suffers. He rejects. He's rejected and he dies. He takes the sins and diseases of Israel upon himself. And they're thinking, how can this be? And so you know what they teach? You know how they reconcile this? They say there must be two Messiahs coming. And they call the one Mashiach ben David, Messiah son of David, because David is like the greatest of the kings, a conqueror, a warrior. And you know what they call the other? Mashiach ben Yosef, Messiah son of Joseph, because Joseph was not recognized by his brothers. He was despised. He was hated. They were jealous of him. They sent him away. They tried to kill him. And so they say there are two messiahs, and so we'll call them these two things. Now we understand there aren't two messiahs, correct? I hope nobody here believes there are two messiahs. There's only one messiah, but he comes at two different times. He came the first time as Messiah, son of Joseph. And again, what was his adoptive father's name? Joseph, right? Mary married Joseph. And so he is known as Yeshua ben Yosef. And when he returns, it will be as that conquering king, as Mashiach ben David. Now what's interesting, is Yeshua a son of David? Yes. Is Yeshua a son of Joseph? He was disguised as one. Joseph was not his real father. He was born of a virgin. But he was known as Mashiach ben Yosef. But the truth is, it's Mashiach ben David. Now we're going to see a story coming up here with Joseph, where his brothers come to him. He recognizes his brothers. They do not recognize him. And here he is, their brother, bringing salvation to the world and salvation to them. And they don't recognize him. He's disguised. And you know, in Revelation, I love it. If you look closely in Revelation, and it's in chapters 4 or 5, where John, he sees God on the throne, and there's a scroll that's sealed with seven seals, and says no man could be found to open the scroll, and John began to weep. And then he says, I heard a voice that says, "Behold the Lion of the tribe of Judah." Okay? Behold the Lion of the tribe of Judah. A lion. Picture a lion in your mind. Okay? Everybody see Aslan. You see a lion in your mind? And then John says, I turned and behold, I saw a what? A lamb. So what is it? Is it a lamb or is it a lion? It's a lion. Oh yes, you could just say both. But he says, behold the Lion of the tribe of Judah. But what he saw looked like a lamb. Except it had seven horns. This is a lamb that's ready for battle. All right, and it looked like it's been slain and it come back to life. So it is a lion, but it appears as a lamb. Yeshua is the Son of David. He is the King of Israel, but he appeared as Messiah ben Yosef. He appeared as one who had no power. He appeared as one who had no authority. And he allowed them to do to him whatever they wanted. And they crucified him, rejected him, crucified him, threw him off. And he allowed them to. If only they'd known what he really was, the Lion of the tribe of Judah. And when he returns, there won't be any question as to who this one is. Now, there's an interesting, I don't like reading Talmud at our Bible studies, but there's a wonderful story, an account in the Talmud. This is in Tractate Sanhedrin. And if you're going to read, I don't encourage people all to read Talmud. I mean, it's like this many volumes on your shelf, big ones, small print. You know, it's a massive body of work. And a lot of it, honestly, just is like, what are they even talking about? But then you come to these places, it's like, wow. So if you are determined to read a volume of Talmud, you get Tractate Sanhedrin. And in there, toward the end of the tractate, it starts talking about the Messiah. With these brilliant concepts these rabbis had about the Messiah and his nature. But there's this one bit I want to read to you. Two rabbis are talking, and it says, Rabbi Alexandri is talking. He says, on the one hand is written, I will hasten it, which implies that God will bring the redemption before its preordained time. Rabbi Yehoshua resolve this contradiction. I should back up a bit. They're talking about, why does it say that the Messiah will come with clouds one place, another place he comes riding on a donkey? In other words, he comes quickly, boom. But here's this, no, the donkey. It's kind of plodding along. And Rabbi Yehoshua said this. It says, on the one hand, it is written, behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a man came, which implies the Messiah will come swiftly from the heavens. But on the other hand, it is written, a humble man riding on a donkey, which implies the Messiah will come sluggishly. He'll come on the earth. Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi resolved this contradiction in this way. He said, if the Jews are deserving, the Messiah will arrive with the clouds of heaven. And if they are not deserving, he will come as a humble man riding on a donkey. Isn't that interesting? No wonder the Pharisees, the scribes, the leaders of Israel were so upset when Messiah came riding into Jerusalem on the back of a donkey, and the people around are singing this messianic psalm, recognizing him as the Messiah. Hoshiana, okay? Baruch haba, b'shem Adonai. And they're singing this messianic song. And here's Messiah. Here's Yeshua coming out of the back of a donkey. No wonder they're irate. He's insulting us. He's saying that we're not deserving of the Messiah. Which leads me to believe, and a lot of traditions also teach, and I think it's indicated in the scriptures, that when he does return, he will come to people who are looking for him. He will come to the children of Jacob who are expecting him and looking for his return. And I think we at Beth Akun are a part of this, because being close to Israel and loving the people of Israel and watching what's going on and to the reports and the testimonies, we know that Jewish people are coming to faith in Messiah Yeshua in numbers like have never been seen since the days of Acts. There's one estimate, which for me is a little difficult to believe, but who knows, that in Jerusalem, the ultra-Orthodox you see with the long black coats and the long peyote and the big hats, and all, that maybe 20 to 25% of them are actually secret believers in Yeshua. Now, again, that's a rumor, but I've had a lot of stories shared with me, first-hand accounts of encounters with these individuals, and when they realize they're speaking to a believing, observant Jewish believer, they will share with them. And it's amazing. I hear these accounts more and more, first-hand accounts. So we live in exciting days, no question about it. I want to take a little time to you to read from a book that was written over 200 years ago, and only about 10 years ago was it finally translated into English. The book is called The Voice of the Turtle Dove, and some of you are familiar with this. It's a difficult book to read, not a long book, but very difficult reading. And what it is, it's the disciple who is also the great nephew of the Vilna Gaon. A Gaon is a word that means genius. And there was this Torah genius who lived in the town of Vilna back in the 1700s, mid-1700s. And in his teachings to his disciples, he taught about the Messiah. And this one disciple, shortly before the Vilna Gaon passed away, wrote out the notes. He wrote it all down. And then later he published it. It was only published in Yiddish or Hebrew. But only about 10 years ago was it translated. And what the Vilna Gaon talks about is Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. And sometimes when you read this, when you hear these things, you may wonder, was he a believer himself? I don't know. But let me just read you a few excerpts. And again, why am I doing this? I want to impress upon you how incredible and amazing this person Joseph is, how elevated he is in the mind of the Jewish people, and how elevated he is in the scriptures. And by reading their traditions about him and about the Messiah, you will begin to appreciate this man Joseph even more. So here's some excerpts. Let's read a few. These are quotes. He writes, "All the rules and details concerning the period from the beginning of the redemption until its conclusion, which include the ingathering of exiles and settlement of the Holy Land, all these are the assignment of the first Messiah, Mashiach ben Yosef." He was very clear that Mashiach ben Yosef must come first, and then Mashiach ben David. And he says, all of these things, all the rules and details concerning the beginning of the redemption. When did the redemption begin? When Yeshua came, when Mashiach ben Yosef came. And all the things to be done for our redemption were accomplished by him. Correct? This is what the Vilna Gaon is saying. Everything that must be done for the redemption is accomplished by Mashiach ben Yosef. He goes on, Mashiach ben Yosef is the miraculous power. You got that? Is the miraculous. Didn't say he had. He is the miraculous power who will assist every act done when the awakening starts from below in a natural manner, because he comes from the earth. Mashiach ben David, however, will come from heaven. He goes on. The writer says, the basic approach of the Vilna Gaon is encapsulated in the principle. You ready for this? It's a quote from Genesis 45:26. Everything about the Mashiach is encapsulated in the principle. Joseph is still alive. Okay? meaning that the Mashiach ben Yosef is still alive and will live because, as it is written, every aspect of the beginning of the redemption is dependent upon him. Thus, the decree of his murder will be canceled by extending the period of the exile, by afflictions that the Mashiach ben Yosef will suffer and diseases he will bear, and also by deeds that he will accomplish with great devotion, such as gathering in exiles, which is his mission. Is that powerful or what? You don't want to hear any more, do you? Okay, I knew you'd say that. All right, let's read a few more. He says, the mission of Joshua, son of Nun, Joshua ben Nun, a descendant of Ephraim, was to fight Amalek. Now, what does Amalek represent? Amalek, the people of licking up. They always represent the fleshly appetites, always. That's another story. But God says, you will eradicate Amalek's name from the earth. But then God says, you'll always be warring against Amalek. I mean, it seems a little contradictory. But, you know, eventually, the appetites of this flesh will be eradicated from the earth. But in the meantime, we're always fighting Amalek, the people of licking up. And then he says, Joshua was a picture of Mashiach ben Yosef. Think about that. Moses couldn't lead the people into the land. Joshua could. Joseph had a rebellious people. I'm sorry, Moses led a very rebellious people. But when Joshua led them, they went in. They conquered. They settled. They worshiped God. Moses could give us the Torah. But under Joshua, the Torah came in with Israel and they followed it. Another quote, if the beginning of the redemption occurs without merit, in other words, if the redemption comes and we're completely undeserving, it will come about like a poor man riding a donkey. Whoever merits carrying out deeds that are characteristic of Mashiach ben Yosef, whoever merits carrying out deeds that are characteristic of Mashiach ben Yosef, you might think, nobody merits it. Yeah, you're right, we don't. But Paul tells us in Ephesians that we've been made acceptable in the Beloved. Our sins are washed away. And we become heirs and joint heirs of Messiah. And that Messiah is not ashamed to call us his brethren. So though we don't truly merit it, yet God has given us the merit of Messiah, so that we can carry out deeds that are characteristic of Mashiach ben Yosef, carry out deeds characteristic of Messiah Yeshua. And he says, whoever merits us, whoever does these, is considered a spark from the root of the soul of Mashiach ben Yosef. In other words, if you're trying to follow Yeshua, to do his will on earth, to live a life like his, he's saying that you are considered a spark from the root of the soul of Messiah. I love that. And what is a spark? It's a light. Yeshua called himself the light of the world. But then he looked at his followers and says, you are lights of the world. Isn't that true? Sparks from the root of the soul of Messiah. A few more. As is known, wherever the term salvation appears. Now, what is the Hebrew word for salvation? Yeshua. That's why when we're praying the prayers in the morning, when we come to the word salvation, many times we just substitute the word Yeshua. So here's what he says. As is known, wherever the term salvation or Yeshua appears, it connotes that characteristic of Mashiach ben Yosef. He goes on and says, the stone which the builders rejected has become the chief cornerstone, Psalm 118:22. The verse refers to an aspect of Yosef. In his blessings to his children, Jacob said about Yosef, from there he became the shepherd, the stone of Israel, Genesis 49:24. He's saying, Jacob blessed Joseph and called him the stone of Israel. And Mashiach ben Yosef is the cornerstone that was rejected, the chief cornerstone. Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. This is one of the traits of Yosef, not only in his own generation, but in every generation. In other words, Mashiach ben Yosef recognizes his brothers, but they do not recognize him. So he talks about Mashiach ben Yosef in every generation, but not being recognized by his brothers. The connection will be brought about by the two messiahs who are like the feet of God. It's almost as if he's saying, you know what, this whole idea of two messiahs aren't two messiahs, aren't two people. He says, think of these two mashiachs as the feet of God. How do you make progress? You put down one foot, then you put down the other. And it's almost like God steps into the world through Mashiach ben Yosef, and the next step he takes, 2,000 years later, is Mashiach ben David. And then he's where he wants to be. Couple more. The first Mashiach, Mashiach ben Yosef, and the one who completes the task is Mashiach ben David. So the one comes before the other. The special task of Mashiach ben Yosef, Messiah son of Joseph, is to counter Esau. What's Esau? The external man. We go back to the teaching about Jacob and Esau, their birth, they're wrestling, they're fighting. Esau's red, he's hairy, a man of the field. He likes to hunt, kill, and eat. Jacob was an internal man. He dwelt in tents. He was a smooth man. He was a scholar. A man who hungered for God. It says the special task of Mashiach ben Yosef is to counter Esau. The special task of Mashiach ben David is against Ishmael. When you think of Ishmael, you know what you should think of? Islam. Okay? Islam. Because Islam is where you take the nature of Esau and turn it into a religion. That's what it is. So the task of Mashiach ben Yosef is to counter Esau. Those physical drives, not physical drives, but the external man. That part of us, that Yetzer Hara, that part of us that wants to rebel against God. But Mashiach ben David, the warrior, the king, the one who comes to slaughter and to kill, his target is Ishmael. You got it? The mixed multitude, these are the people of the world who don't care about God at all. This is what he says. The mixed multitude is the one who attempts to couple Esau and Ishmael. And this could destroy Israel and the entire world, heaven forbid. There's no question about it that the Vilna Gaon was a genius. And his grasp of the scriptures, his grasp of all the writings, concerning Israel. He was able to take these, to digest them, to focus on them, and to see deeply into the nature of our Messiah and our God. Can you imagine what he could have done had he had the New Testament scriptures as well to assist him? Wow. Yes, Janet, question.
What would you tell us the name of that book and where we can find it?
I actually think it's out of print. They just printed a few copies. But it's called The Voice of the Turtle Dove, and the author is Shacklover. Shacklover, which is spelled S-H-A-K, lover, L-O-V-E-R, Shacklover. So you can do a search, you might find a used one somewhere. There might be some new ones out there, but it's a difficult book to find, and difficult book to read as well.
Would it be in a library?
Possibly, unlikely, but it's possible. Sorry to disappoint you folks. I read you all the juicy parts anyway. So. All right. So, in chapter 37, verse 2, these are the toldot, the generations, the genealogy of Jacob, Joseph. You begin to understand how shocking this was and yet how it encapsulates everything that's come up to this point and brought Jacob into the world and Rachel. It was to bring forth this one offspring. Because you must understand that Joseph literally was the savior of the world in that day. The whole world was starving during the 7 years of famine. And there was one place they could go to find food. That was to Egypt. Because there was one man put in charge of Egypt, and that was Joseph. And Joseph charged the money. He took the gold. He took all the possessions from the world. He took them and gathered them all to himself there in Egypt. And then you go down a few centuries to the children of Israel. And when they leave Egypt, they go out with the wealth of Joseph. You see, they took that wealth with them. And that wealth that Joseph accumulated became the wealth that was used to build the tabernacle. You follow? Get to follow the story. Yes, Jim.
In saying that the brothers of Joseph didn't recognize him because he was in disguise, is there an implication that the Messiah didn't necessarily want to be recognized by his brothers?
He wanted to be recognized spiritually. This is why he told us, that's a great question. The question was, for the sake of the recording, is when Joseph was not recognized by his brothers, and Joseph is a picture of Messiah, does Messiah not want to be recognized? The answer is yes and no, as most questions are answered, yes and no. He wants to be recognized, but not according to the flesh. He wants to be recognized according to the Spirit. In fact, Jim, that was a great question. It brings up a passage in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 that answers that. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Now, when Messiah returns as Messiah, Mashiach ben David, says every eye will see him. All right? Every eye will see him. We'll all recognize him. We'll lay eyes on him, and that's the Messiah. But when he comes the first time, we don't recognize him with our eyes. We recognize him as something deeper. This is why when Peter says, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God," he says, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal that to you." In other words, you didn't get it from human logic and from looking at me. It was revealed by who? My Father in heaven. He says, "Upon this rock I'll build my kahal." What rock? The rock of people confessing Yeshua as Messiah, because there's an inward recognition of who he is, not because of some kind of outward glitz, signs and wonders or whatever. Now, in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, let's start with verse 16. 2 Corinthians 5:16. "Therefore, from now on, we recognize no one according to the flesh. Even though we have known Messiah according to the flesh, yet now we know him in this way no longer." This is, remember, you ever wonder why Yeshua says, "It's imperative for you that I go away"? You know, after his resurrection, "I've got to go away." He knew us so well. He knew that if he remained here, we'd be so physically oriented on him, we'd all be jumping on planes to travel to Jerusalem so we could see him. Oh, there he is. We want pictures of him, make scrapbooks of pictures of him. We'd have blogs about where he's at, where he's traveling. We'd be so fixated on the physical, we would never develop a true, intimate relationship with him spiritually. And that's the way he wants to be known. Because the spiritual is the real and the true. Everything else is the dressing. Everything else is the clothing of the truth. So, and it goes on. That's good enough. That's the only verse we need to look at there. Okay, you follow? Follow how important that is? All right. There's a tradition in Judaism. You know, they look up at Abraham as this incredible man of faith, and he was. He absolutely was. But they look at Isaac and then at Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel. And they're named after Israel. They're not named after Abraham. They're named after Israel, Prince of God. They look at Jacob as being almost like this individual who finally, and you don't have to agree with this, I don't agree with it, but this is how the Jewish mindset looks at this. They look at Jacob as one who finally made his way back up the ladder, so to speak, to where he's at the level of Adam before his sin. All right? Now, I have a hard time with that, but in Jewish lore, that's how they think about Jacob. He's one who's finally climbed the ladder. He's finally achieved this place where he's at the status of Adam. And they say, in several of their writings, that on God's throne, Jacob's face is engraved. Right? It's an interesting way to think about it, isn't it? Now, here's what they say about Joseph. Yes, Ray.
This has always troubled me. The Bible doesn't say, but why do you suppose God put Jacob through all that? He intended him to become Israel, but he was born second. Then he had to dishonor his parents, dishonor his brother, steal the birthright, which was God had always intended for him to have.
Right. Yeah, well, when he was born, he was called Yaakov, heel, which also means grasper. He was born grasping his brother's heel. He was a fighter. He was a scrapper. And he fought for all these things God was going to give him anyway. So, you see, Jacob is like two people. He's like all the Jewish people, because they all have been scrappers, you know, moving, and they're tenacious, and they're tough people. But God promised them blessings if they just follow his Torah. Jacob's also a picture of every one of us. Because we're always trying to grasp and get hold and move up. And God says, I want to elevate you anyway. Just follow me. Just walk with me. Just obey me. Okay? But Jacob's a picture of us. And Jacob's life of moving from being a Jacob to being an Israel is a picture of everyone's life. We're all in this wrestling match with God, thinking he's the enemy. Until the lights come up, we say, oh, I'm not letting you go. Do you bless me? You know? And again, he asks Jacob, what's your name? He says, Jacob. He says, no longer your name be Jacob, but Israel, because you have power with man with God. And then Jacob asks his name. And going back to Jim's question, what does God say? Why do you need to ask my name? You know who I am. Right? I'm not going to tell you physically, because I want you to recognize spiritually. So everything about Jacob becoming Israel is a picture of a person moving from being physically oriented to being spiritually oriented. You know, this Torah scroll that we read from this morning, we're getting near the end, all right? And you notice the one end is real fat, the other end's getting real skinny. And as you go through the Torah scroll from Genesis to Deuteronomy, you start off and there's no weight on the right side. And all the way the Torah is over on the left. The right's the side of the spiritual, the left side of the physical. But as you read your way through the Torah, what happens? All that transfers from the left over to the right. That's the story of us. That's the story of Israel. That's the story of Jacob. Yeah. So that's an excellent question. And you got an extra sermon for free out of that question, didn't you? So here, let me read one of the rabbinic commentaries. And again, I'm not teaching this, that this is scripture. I'm saying I want you to understand the Jewish mindset of how great this man Joseph was. So I'm just going to read it. Here's what it says. It says, Joseph resembled Jacob. Jacob, he looked like Jacob. Perhaps Joseph looked like his father. Perhaps he was the image of his mother. Perhaps all 11 of his brothers looked more like Jacob. All that is immaterial. But if someone could look at Joseph and say, he has a beauty like that of the man whose essence is engraved in God's plan of creation, then Joseph was truly a cut above his brothers, a son worthy of his father's attention. That sort of beauty is not visible to everyone. Only a spiritual person can appreciate spiritual beauty. And the more attuned someone is to holiness, the more he can discern nuances and varying levels in holiness. Just as experts in any field can identify differences in quality where laymen recognize nothing. As we shall see below in detail, Joseph's greatness made him the spiritual heir of his father, and his eminence found outward expression in a facial beauty like Jacob's and Adam's. If the brothers' perception had not been clouded by the resentment of Joseph, they could have seen it. After he revealed himself in Egypt and made peace with them, they surely recognized that he was more than just brother number 11. And they must have reported that back to Jacob. When they said that Joseph is alive, they meant a quality of life far above animal functioning. That is all true, but only Jacob could perceive from Joseph's face how great he was, how much of his Adam-like beauty had remained. Who is the first Adam? Adam. Who's the last Adam? Messiah. You know, this. They're explaining here why it is that when Jacob heard Joseph is still alive, he says, I'm going to go down, I'm going to see his face. He wanted to see his face again. Because they're saying there's something Jacob recognized in Joseph that no one else could. There was a spiritual essence to him. One more quote. Joseph was the symbol of peace, so he was tested in predicaments involving strife and alienation. Could he suffer jealousy, hatred, accusation, assault, and loss of freedom at the hands of his brothers? Sounds like Yeshua, doesn't it? Could he suffer jealousy, hatred, accusation, assault, and loss of freedom at the hands of his brothers, yet remain the seeker of peace and harmony? Only through such excruciating tests can greatness be established. Joseph is described as the Tzaddik, the righteous one. And his attribute is Yesod, foundation. He explains, to be truly righteous, one must assign each function its proper place, time, and degree. This is a wonderful thing about Yeshua. Yeshua could assign everything its proper function, time, and degree. This is why when you'd think it's time to stone the adulterer, he could say, all right, whosoever without sin for the first stone. They walk away, he tells the woman, says, where are your condemners? Well, they're gone. Well, I don't condemn you either. Go and sin no more. When he finds people selling into the temple, he drives them out with a whip. He can meet a true sinner and be their friend, the friend of sinners, and yet when he meets the religious hypocrites, he calls them he's harsh on them. You whitewashed tombs, white on the outside, full of rottenness and corruption inside. You know, you pit of vipers, you know, and you make others twice the sons of hell that you are. I mean, he was breathing fire. But he knew exactly when to be one, when to be the lion, when to be the lamb. He knew the right time, the right degree, exactly. He pinned it every time, right at the bullseye. And that's what they're saying about Joseph. Wherever he went, he won the trust of his master, whether it was Jacob, Potiphar, the head of his prison, or Pharaoh. Joseph mastered his drives and temptations as well. For this reason, he was the Tzaddik, the righteous one of his family, and became the foundation upon which Israel and the whole world could be established. They're writing about Joseph here. Now they're saying this about Joseph, and we know Joseph to be a picture of Messiah. See how you can transfer the Jewish mindset about this man and put it right on Messiah. I could have read this quote, and instead of taking Joseph's name, just put Yeshua in there. You'd say amen to every sentence. This is the picture this man was of our Messiah. Therefore, Joseph represents the one name of God, because his life revealed the harmony and balance in earthly terms that reflect the essence of God's perfection. And what is Yeshua called? He's called the image of the one God, the true God. In him, the fullness of the Godhead dwelt bodily. I mean, it's incredible to look at this. So, quickly, I want to share a little summary, and we'll close, and we can go eat. So here's what, according to Jewish tradition, these are the things that earmark Joseph. He had a spiritual beauty that only his father could recognize. And what does it say of Yeshua? He had no comeliness or beauty that we should desire him. But we know that the Father recognized, and we know that those whose hearts are awakened recognize. He was a spiritual firstborn of Israel. Yeshua is the firstborn of all creation. He had Jacob's face. In other words, he looked just like Jacob. And Yeshua was a true Jew. He was a true Israelite. But he had Adam's face. Yeshua is also the last Adam. And just as the first Adam, by his sin, affected the entire world, Yeshua, by his sacrifice, affected the entire world. Paul says this in Romans 5 very adamantly. He was the foundation upon which the world could be established, the chief cornerstone. He reflects the essence of God's perfection. Now again, this is what the rabbis say about Joseph. And our Yeshua was called Yeshua ben Yosef. He is the Mashiach, son of Joseph. And everything about Joseph in the scriptures and even in Jewish tradition is a picture of our wonderful, amazing Messiah. One other thing. I should say one other list of things. Jacob and Joseph I want you to look at this list. We'll go through it very quickly. Their lives were very parallel. Because here's the wonderful thing about Messiah. If someone says, is Messiah human or is he divine? The answer is yes. All right? In Yeshua's life, everything about him, as we've just seen, is a picture of godliness, perfection, the foundation of the world, the firstborn of creation, the one who has the face of Adam, the image of God. He has this, he sums up all the essence of God's perfection. On the other hand, he looks just like Jacob, the one who's born the heel. And look at this list. Look at how Joseph parallels Jacob. Both were born to childless mothers, which sounds kind of odd. You can't be a mother if you're childless. But their mothers had a difficult time giving birth. They were the first of the children born. Now, Jacob, of course, had a twin brother. But Joseph was the first born to Rachel. Their mothers bore two children each. Rebekah bore Jacob and Esau. Rachel bore Joseph and Benjamin. Both were hated by their brothers. Jacob by Esau, Joseph by his brothers. Their brothers sought to kill them. Both were shepherds. Each was blessed with 10 blessings. This is an easy one to miss. By the way, this list also comes in the Midrash Rabbah, and I shortened it to some of the more pertinent ones. But Jacob blesses Joseph. Isaac blesses Jacob in Genesis 27. You can count there are 10 blessings. And then when you get to Deuteronomy, Moses blesses Joseph, the tribe of Joseph, and blesses him with 10 blessings. Now, the nature of those blessings is very revealing, too. You see the human and divine in there as well. Both immigrated from the land. Both took wives outside the land. Both begot children outside the land. Both were promoted through a dream. Jacob had the dream of the ladder, the sulam, and God's voice and God's blessing and promoting him and encouraging him to go on, and he'd be with him. And of course, Joseph was through dreams. It's interesting to think, too, of Joseph, Mary's husband. How did God always communicate to that Joseph? Through dreams. You go to Matthew, go to Luke. It's always through a dream God speaks to Joseph, the same way as in Genesis here to this Joseph. Both their fathers-in-law were blessed on their account. Laban was blessed because of Jacob. Potiphar was blessed because of Joseph. Do you realize that Joseph married not Potiphar's wife, Potiphar's daughter he married, okay? Potipharah was her name. Both went down to Egypt. Both died in Egypt. Both commanded that they be buried in the land. Both were embalmed. Scriptures are very specific. Jacob was embalmed and Joseph was embalmed. And both were carried back and buried in the land. Now, why do I share this list with you? What's the point of this? Well, as you look at this list, I want you to think of Messiah for a moment. You see, Messiah was the picture of who God is. When he spoke, you heard God's words. When he lived and acted, you saw God's actions. And yet, Yeshua's life paralleled the history of Israel. And you may not be aware of that, but just a brief summary, and we'll close in prayer. Did Yeshua go to Egypt and come out of Egypt? Yes. Out of Egypt I've called my son. Remember how Israel passed through the water, the Red Sea, that went into 40 years of testing in the wilderness? When Yeshua was baptized, when he came up out of the water, he went into the wilderness to be tested for 40 days. Due to Israel's sin, their temple was destroyed, and then they were scattered among the nations. Yeshua never sinned, but because of the sin of Israel, Yeshua's temple was destroyed. Remember at his trial, what was the phrase they finally used to convict him? He said, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And he's talking about the temple of his body. So this is Israel's temple was destroyed because of their sin. The temple of Yeshua was destroyed because of Israel's sin. And as Israel was exiled to the nations, what did Yeshua tell his disciples? To go into every nation and make students. Right? And you can think of the believers in Messiah, we're in exile right now. There's a day coming when the exiles will be gathered in. But just as Israel returned to the land and the temple was rebuilt, a new temple, Yeshua is going to return and a new temple will be rebuilt and the exiles will be gathered in. You see how the story of Yeshua and the story of Jacob and his children parallel each other? All right. So I just wanted to give you some background, some introduction. I wanted you to have a mindset about Joseph before we go deeper into the scriptures here. And next week we're going to start flying through this. Well, not next week. We have a guest speaker next week. But 2 weeks we're going to start flying through. Very slow, laborious flight, but we'll be flying through Genesis. All right. So let's close in a word of prayer. And then we'll stand, and then I'm going to invite Ben to come up. He'll do the blessing over the cup and over the bread. We can sing the Baraka, and then you can grab your kids, and we can go eat. Okay. All right, let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your precious Torah. Thank you, Father. This is a lamp to our feet and a light to our paths. And I pray, Lord, you'd give us spiritual eyes to look deeply into your Torah, into your word, and there we would see the face of our beloved Messiah, Yeshua. And Lord, I pray that as we look into his face, as we see him more clearly in your word, we would become more like him. We'd become more pleasing to you. Lord, I pray that as Messiah helps us do battle against our own Esau's, against those drives in us that want us to live like animals, Lord, I pray we would have victory. And we would arise to be and to walk as lights of the world, as children of the Father, as brothers and sisters of the Messiah. Make us the people you want us to be, we ask, Father, in the precious name of Yeshua. Amen. Well, Ben, if you would...